Do Florida's teachers need a raise? Good morning and live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for being with us. And just ahead this morning, a closer look at the governor's proposed pay hike for Florida's teachers. We're already getting your calls about this. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, mental health first aid comes to town. We'll tell you about that. But first this morning, Governor Ron DeSantis is proposing a pay raise for Florida's teachers. DeSantis announced Monday in Middleburg that he'll urge Florida lawmakers to raise the minimum starting salary for teachers to $47,500 a year. Florida ranks currently near the bottom in the nation for average teacher pay, and salary raises have been something teachers have long sought from Tallahassee. According to data collected by the National Education Association, the average starting teacher salary in Florida is about $37,000 a year. We're going to take a closer look at this and what it might mean for the state's budget as we welcome Frederick Ingram. He's on the line. He heads up the Florida Education Association representing the state's teachers. Frederick, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us in studio, Frederick's local counterpart, Terry Brady of Duval Teachers United.
Good morning, Melissa.
To you. Thanks for being with us. And we're already getting your calls. What's your reaction to the governor's proposal to give Florida's teachers a raise? It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Frederick Ingram of FEA, let's start with you. Ron DeSantis is saying teachers need to start at $47,500 a year. What's the teachers union's reaction to that, first off?
So thank you. And again, thank you for having me. Listen, any opportunity that we have to get money into the pockets of our hardworking teachers is a step forward. And so we applaud the governor for a step forward. You know, it's long overdue. The cries of our teachers have gone on for years, and we know the residual effect of not paying our teachers. What we've seen over the last couple of years is starting schools statewide with 3,000-plus classrooms that did not have a certified teacher. That is a direct result of teachers not being able to look at the teaching profession as something that they can do and sustain themselves moving forward. We also know that there are fewer students, young students, that are choosing the profession of teaching. And one way that we can incentivize that is to give teachers a raise to make it more affordable, more livable, and a professional way of living and helping our children in every community.
The governor seems to be buying into the argument you're making that teachers should be paid more of a professional salary. Now, the state has been struggling with a teacher shortage, of course, for many years, which teachers unions are blaming, as you've said, on these low salaries. This would cost about $600 million, and the legislature would have to pass it. How likely is that, Frederick?
Well, we hope that it's highly likely. But listen, the devil is in the details in terms of this plan. It wasn't very comprehensive. What we know is that he wants to start $47,500 for every teacher. But there are a lot of different details. I'll just go into a couple of them. We hope that the governor and the legislature considers the collective bargaining aspect of what's going into this. We also know that there was mention of bonuses that, in addition to this, for our veteran teachers. We know that bonus programs do not work, and we hope that this is not an effort to prop up this accountability system. We hope that these evaluation tools that they've used for merit pay and performance pay are not additive to what the governor has proposed. So again, there's so many questions that are unanswered. We appreciate the step forward, but we need some details, and teachers are watching. Not only teachers are watching, but I will tell you this, that there is an educational village out there that bus drivers and secretaries, school security monitors, paraprofessionals, people who work for our children every day ought to be respected, and they ought to be compensated as such as well. And so we're looking for any avenue that we can to develop a financial plan around the entire educational community.
We'll go to your calls in just a moment. It's 549-2937. as we talk about the governor's proposal to raise Florida's teacher salaries. Let's go now to Terry Brady of Duval Teachers United. You represent teachers here in Duval County. Terry, fill us in on what teachers in Northeast Florida are making and how this would change their take-home pay.
Thank you very much, Melissa, for having us this morning. And this is a very important issue. I, too, like Fed, would like to thank the governor for stepping up and starting the conversation that our educators in the state of Florida are underpaid, way below the national average. Here in Duval County, the starting pay is $39,500. If the governor's proposed plan goes into effect, it would give starting teachers an $8,000 bump. But nowhere in the detail does it talk about all employees that are currently below $47,500. Here in Duval County, 4,700 plus teachers make below $47,500. And then above that, we have about 3,000 teachers that are already at that level or above. So we want to make sure that our teachers that are above that get some kind of money. And then those that are below that, that it is sustainable. Another question, Melissa, that a lot of our teachers are starting to ask is, currently right now in Duval County, to even meet the $47,000 threshold, you have to work 16 years. Would a 16-year teacher be making the exact same equivalent as an entry-level new teacher entering into the district? And that question, of course, has not been asked. And we believe that experience and best knowledge and practices and pedagogy do play a role in that enhancement of funds. So we're going to wait to see what that detail is and how we go about spreading it throughout the entire salary schedule with collective bargaining.
Okay, so overall, it's good news, but as you both are saying, the devil is in the details. It might not apply to every teacher in the classroom, is what I hear you saying, Terry.
Correct. And in the past laws that have been passed, they talk about teachers. But then when the details come out, they exclude our psychologists, our guidance counselors, our ESE push-in teachers, our speech and language pathologists, all those educators who lend support to those classroom teachers to help enrich and assist in the development and academic needs of our students. And they've all been excluded in the past, and we haven't heard whether they are going to be included in this process of hiring. But Melissa, you might need to note that besides just recruiting teachers, we want to be able to retain teachers in Duval County. And just like all the 67 counties around the state, we do have a shortage of teachers, not just because we can't hire them, but because teachers are leaving the teaching force because of all the unfunded mandates and the demands that are being placed on them every single day. Like right now, currently in Duval County, as of last Friday, we have 192 teaching vacancies in Duval County right now where substitutes are teaching our students. And the worst part is we have 131 paraprofessional vacancies. And these are the individuals, we call them our angels. They go in and they assist teachers in most of them are ESE classroom students with learning difficulties. And these classrooms are going unfulfilled by these integral part of assistance with our education community because people won't come in and work for that pay. Mm-hmm. And those individuals have been left out of the conversation by the governor so far. This is a beginning process. And like Fed said earlier, we need to make sure that we watch the process, that we're diligent, and we have an active role in lending our conversations to this process.
Okay, let's go to your calls. Lots of calls as we speak now with Frederick Ingram of the Florida Education Association and Terry Brady of Duval Teachers United. As Governor Ron DeSantis on Monday said, it's time to give Florida's teachers a raise. He's proposing a starting salary for the state's teachers of $47,500 a year. What do you think about that? Let's go to Kay in White House. Kay, good morning. How are you? Go ahead.
Good morning. Listen, do you remember, I know Terry should remember, that when the lottery came into being, they promised to give the teachers, if we will allow them to have a lottery in the state of Florida, they was going to give X amount of dollars to the teachers. They did not. And I would like the governor and maybe Terry to see they make profits. People winning lotteries, $500,000.
Yeah, thanks, Kay.
$500,000.
I know it. You know, Kay, every time we talk about education issues on the show, someone calls in and asks about the Florida lottery and how that money is apportioned. Frederick and then Terry, could you answer her question? Because people always express frustration that the lottery does not seem to be allocating enough funds toward education as was originally intended.
Sure. And thank you very much for that question. The lottery, the lion's share of the lottery money in terms of the state funding goes to a program called the Bright Futures Scholarship. And Terry can elaborate on that on the local level and what that does for students. But what we've seen over the last 20 years is a disinvestment throughout our state. And so I think the caller is absolutely right that we started 20 years ago where we were 26th in the nation, right in the middle of the pack in terms of states in the nation for teacher pay. And we have devolved to 46th in the nation. And so there, and from our vantage point, there's been a systematic disinvestment in our public schools. And you start to see that in teacher salaries. And you're now starting to see that, as Terry mentioned, with all of the vacancies and people not coming into the profession simply because they cannot afford to do it as a career. And so that's unfortunate from where we are. I think the lottery is definitely a question that we have to continue to ask. Where is that money and why isn't it being applied in the original way that it was supposed to be applied? There's been many different iterations of that over the last 20 years. But we do need an investment. And I just want to say one more thing, that the Florida Education Association is calling for what we call a decade of progress, which is a $22 billion investment over 10 years, which we're asking for $2.4 billion of that to be part of the legislative talks this year. That $2.4 billion increase would give every public school employee a 10% raise. And we believe that that is a more equitable system in order to advance and move forward.
You're calling for more than $2 billion to be invested in public education in the next state budget. That is far more than what DeSantis is talking about.
Yes, ma'am, because this has been an ongoing problem for the last 20 years, and our governor knows that, our legislators know that. We have to reinvest in our kids, and there is no amount of money that we should not be willing to put into our state coffers, which goes directly into all of our communities, to all of our kids. These are about programs for our kids. This is about art, band, and science, which is what we're calling for. That $2.4 billion is not exclusive to salaries. It is talking about student success and all of the things that are surrounding those teachers and educational support professionals to make those schools the best that they can possibly
okay.
be.
Okay, and Terry Brady, at the local level, we're seeing this same controversy play out. A fight over a half-cent sales tax for school funding in Duval County as the school board is battling with the city over trying to levy a half-cent sales tax just to shore up some old dilapidated school buildings. So around the state, we see this frustration with parents, teachers, students, school board members over what is they perceive to be a disinvestment in public education. How do you turn that around in a state where the legislature is not inclined to see things your way and hasn't been for some time?
Melissa, sometimes I think we try to muddy the waters and make things very difficult, find difficult solutions. The number one solution is for parents and educators and community leaders who believe in public education. And that just does not just mean our traditional schools, but all schools that educate children, to truly mobilize and energize and stand up for that investment, for not only now, but for our future, for all of our students coming up in the ranks. It's just, I cannot believe that we are quivering over building schools when Jacksonville has the oldest schools in the state of Florida. Over 120 of our schools are 50 years or older, and a lot of them cannot be retrofitted. We can't do and provide for our students what they need in the learning environment. And here we are quivering, we're arguing over simple terms. And that is why we have filed a joint lawsuit with our school district, because our children and the future of our school district is worth fighting for.
We'll continue discussing that along with another proposal that's being floated to change Duval County's appointed superintendent position to an elected one. We'll get to that in a moment, Terry. But first, let me get some more callers on the air. Beth is on the south side. Hey, Beth, we're talking education on the show this morning. What are your thoughts?
Oh, man, this is a great topic that you're covering today, and certainly we need to address education funding. I was wondering if your guests would address the difference between public and private school salaries, and also how teachers' benefit package relates with that, because the benefit package is pretty substantial for these employees. And I've had just a little background. I've had students who've graduated from public school and a student who we've moved to private school. And frankly, the private school teachers, they earn less money, but the private school gives a way better education to my son, who happens to also be an ESE student. So I really appreciated the comments that were made about that. And I've seen teachers leave the private school setting to go to public, largely because of salary, and the other way around.
Okay.
Public school going to private. So I wonder how much the salary and the benefits really plays into it versus the administrative support and the state rules.
Okay, yeah. Thanks, Beth. Frederick Ingram, what are your thoughts about that? And also, can you explain how the DeSantis proposal would apply to teachers in publicly funded charter schools, too?
Yeah, so I don't know how the governor is intending charter schools to play into this. Those questions remain largely unanswered. But I do want to touch upon this issue of public versus private. Listen, there are some very good private schools. Let me just say that. And there are some very good public schools. What we ought to be talking about is pulling from the best of those schools, because the best private schools have small class sizes. The best private schools have all the resources that they need and all the support systems and all the lab equipment and band equipment that kids need. You know, the best private schools have really good leadership. And so we need to do the same things and the same fixtures for our public schools. Our public schools, unfortunately, are guarded by this lawmaker's attempt to have accountability and testing around our teachers and not give them the ability and the autonomy to do what they know is right for students. They've built a structure that makes it just untenable for some teachers to do what they need to do at our schools. And so if we're coming together, then we need to talk about the best aspects of how we make education better. Our public schools, there are some really good public schools, especially in Duval County, and we've got to be able to let lawmakers know and force their hand to make sure that these schools have what they need in terms of resources, support, leadership, and getting the best people that we can get in those schools. And so that's the biggest difference, that private schools don't have this system that has been developed around our public schools, and public schools, unfortunately, have what we believe an accountability system that is far broken for our teachers and our students.
Terry Brady.
Thank you, Melissa. I think our caller brought up a great issue. It talked about why some teachers leave and others go to private schools versus the public schools. Let's talk about the benefit packages. When we go to the table to negotiate, we just don't negotiate salaries. We negotiate working conditions, and we negotiate a benefit package. That's their health care. We negotiate their salaries. We negotiate some supplements, which counts towards their retirement, and some of the extra work that they do. We have collective bargaining. In all of the charter schools that I know, and even in the voucher schools that are not charter schools, the private schools, they do not have collective bargaining, to my knowledge. And so they get what their board of directors can either afford or what they offer them. We believe currently right now, with the limited financial resources we have to build a package that is sustainable. That means it's ongoing, and that we can meet a total benefit package for our employees. I believe, just like I know our state organization believes, that all parents should have a choice. Our caller mentioned that her child is an ESE student that took the voucher, the McKay voucher, and went to a school and is flourishing. I am so happy for that student and the school that is providing those services. But all things in charter and voucher school should be equal to that of the public schools, traditional public schools. All of the requirements for certification, all of the requirements for testing, all of the unfunded mandates for one should be on the other. Everything should be the same across the board.
But it's not.
And it's not right now. And Melissa,
and let me challenge you a little bit on this. How the teachers union, critics might say, isn't being very effective in challenging the standing that you're talking about.
Well,
what about that?
We are effective because here in Duval County, we're a right to work state, and we represent far more than just the bare minimum of 50% of the employees. We are their voice, and we are working very hard to make a difference. The problem is when they go to Tallahassee, they don't ever, quote, ask a teacher. Bring in the Florida Education Association. Talk about with an organization that has the pulse of 144,000 employees who can give input as to what it would take to recruit and retain, what it would take to make safe and healthy classrooms, what it takes to truly fund strong academic programs, not just those being tested on FSA, but like what Fed brought up, foreign languages, art, music, the band, the choir, all the other things that we know that develop and build a whole child. As far as I know, our organization, Florida Education Association, has not been brought into the conversation with the governor to have an exchange of what will work and what is sustainable. That's the key to this. Bonus plans are not sustainable. Our teachers want to have a future. They want to be in education 10, 15, 20, 30 years. That's why they're doing the job. But a lot of times our employees are run off because nothing is sustainable. And there's so many unfunded mandates.
Right.
They literally take the money out of their pockets to meet the needs of kids.
And let me get just a few tweets on the air as we talk about the governor's proposal to raise teacher salaries in Florida. They are among some of the lowest paid educators in the nation. Here's a tweet from David. It's about time, but it needs to be more and across the board and higher. We don't pay enough for those who affect our lives so deeply. Do we really want cut-rate teachers? They deserve more than any football player, he says.
Yay, David.
Here's another tweet. To break even with 2007 in real dollars, we need more than $1,000 per pupil appropriated. That is close to $3 billion. That's a whole lot more than $600 million. Citizens and voters are awake to Tallahassee's public school starvation. Here's one more tweet for you. The USSR always had a very ambivalent attitude about education, and Florida is near the head of the pack in that, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Okay, and Frederick Ingram of the Florida Education Association, here's an email that we received this morning from a teacher here in Jacksonville. It's a long email, but I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. A large flaw in DeSantis's plan is the state cannot determine teacher salaries as it violates their collective bargaining rights. Salaries are something by law districts and teachers' representatives and their unions negotiate for. I also don't think just raising salaries will make that much of a difference, not with teachers being stripped of autonomy, creativity, and work protections, and forced to endure runaway accountability on steroids. He says DeSantis should insist the state legislature add $1,000 to the per pupil formula. That goes back to a tweet from another listener. Frederick Ingram, do you agree?
Yes. So let me say this. There are a couple of different things in there. What we saw in the last administration with the Rick Scott administration was there was an attempt to pay teachers. And so there is a provision that allows lawmakers to either do statutory language or a line item budget language. And so they can push teacher pay or whatever pay through the legislature. In some instance, on the last administration, Rick Scott gave a $2,500 raise, which is currently a line item budget that is recurring through the budgetary process. But we absolutely agree that collective bargaining is job one. That means that we need to increase the base student allocation. I think it was referenced as something else a little earlier, but the base student allocation is the money that allows school districts to actually run, to operate, to collectively bargain and negotiate. And we certainly agree that this base student allocation needs to be more last year. I want to thank.
And how are you going? How are you going to try to convince the legislature to do that?
So we have a lot of different means. We work every day in the Capitol here. Our members, more importantly, are working at home. People like Terry, our local leaders, are oftentimes in delegation meetings. They're going to these lawmakers' offices. We know that the power is at the ballot box. You know, these folks, we need people who are going to support public education coming to Tallahassee. And so that is a local process. And so we will continue to push our agenda. We will continue to tell our community and our parents. And we have a full plethora of partners now and affiliates that are working with us from churches and pastors, civic and social organizations. This notion that teachers are underpaid is not because lawmakers are starting to see the light. There's pressure out there, and people are starting to talk about the woefully underfunded schools and teacher pay and our educational support staff pay that is going on out there. And so we believe that the pressure is mounting and will continue to mount all the way through the legislature.
All right, let's take a few more calls as we talk about the governor's proposal to give teachers in Florida a raise. Teachers say, not surprisingly, this is long overdue. Sarah is in St. John's County. Hi, Sarah. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, what is it going to take to increase the level, the quality of the level of education in Florida? Right now, it's ranked pretty low. I moved about 2 years from New Jersey, and I have two kids that are ESE, and I regret almost every single day that I moved them to participate in the public school education in Florida.
Really? Even in St. John's County? They have the highest ranked schools in the state of Florida. You're not happy with them?
Yes. Nope. So from my perspective, it's the highest of the lowest.
Hmm.
And I guess, I'm comparing it to New Jersey, which is ranked very high. But again,
what is it about their schools that displeases you? I'm just curious.
Having children with learning differences, they do not provide the proper instructions that my children need. In fact, I spend thousands of dollars on a monthly basis trying to provide them the necessary instruction based on their learning differences.
Okay, Sarah, thanks for your call. Terry Brady, you represent Duval teachers, but what about her call?
First of all, anytime you hear comments made like that by a parent, your heart goes out to her because you only want the best for the children. And if you're a parent, you truly want the best for your children to build their future. I believe that we've got to look at the entire education system as a whole. For so long now, we have been educating students on a shoestring budget, no matter what the propaganda and the smoke screens say, that they've increased education funding, that they've given us more dollars, but they've also given us greater amounts of unfunded mandates. So when finally the legislative session is over and it comes back to local districts, our school boards, and frankly through collective bargaining and not, they have to make tough decisions on how schools are staffed, what programs are funded, can we maximize, can we bring in greater enhancements for children that need special needs to make sure that they flourish in every single aspect, not including the programs that we offer for all of our students in our county.
Okay. And let me jump in because I know we could keep mm-hmm. talking about that, but since we are a little tight on time, I want to get you on the record about something else that's happening. A proposal to change Duval County's education leadership from an appointed superintendent to an elected superintendent. Here's a tweet from a listener. This is just an attempt to inject big money and donor class political control into school matters. We need an expert, not a politician. As superintendent, how is Duval Teachers United reacting to this proposal, which may or may not get approved?
We are very strongly in opposition to this J bill, which means it's a bill that's only local to Jacksonville. We are starting to mobilize our members to ask our Duval delegation to vote no November 1st at a delegation meeting against this. And we have a lot of questions to this. Why now? We are less than 0.5% away from being an A district. We have made substantial gains in our academic achievements, and we've got the highest graduation rate, when the 80-something percent that we've ever had. And we don't understand why it's now. I can tell you, Melissa, that I can make some assumptions. Maybe it's because our current superintendent has not acquiesced to a lot of the political movers and shakers on how education funding should be distributed. Maybe it's because we have our first female minority superintendent in the history of our district. Maybe it's just because they want control over one of the largest budgets in the city. I don't know that question. The sponsor of this bill was sitting on the school board. Why wasn't that bill proposed while the individual was on the school board? Why wasn't it proposed when the person first served his first term in the Florida legislature?
You're talking about Jason Fisher.
Representative Jason Fisher. And why now? Maybe it's because after the mayor had a press conference where he interjected that he would like to see an elected superintendent. Maybe that's the reason why. I don't know. But currently, right now, in the state of Florida, Melissa, all seven major urban districts have appointed superintendents. Our last elected superintendent was over 50 years ago. Under that leadership, every school in the state of Florida was disaccredited because political patronism took place in lieu of what was right in education pedagogy and the knowledge that it brought forth.
All right. So definitely understand your opposition to that proposal, which we'll continue to follow. And before we let you go, Frederick Ingram, your next moves as this process to raise teacher salaries in Florida makes its way through the upcoming legislative session.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. And listen, the power is always with our parents. We want our community to know that our teachers are working really, really hard. We want a good school with quality teachers in every zip code for every child. That is what matters to teachers. It is the heart of teaching. But we also know that teachers are professional, and they need a professional and respectful pay and compensation package as well, so that they can send their own kids to college, so that they can, be able to live their own American dream. This is the esprit de corps. This is the morale that goes into our schools, and so we can only hope to uplift that. And so I'm sending a message to all of our parents to be alert, be aware, speak up for our teachers, speak out for our schools, because our public schools are still those vessels of hope for every single kid in every single community across this state.
Frederick Ingram heads up the Florida Education Association, and Terry Brady, Duval Teachers United, both with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thank you.
A quick break, and then up next, promoting mental health first aid here on the First Coast. What's that? We'll tell you right after this.
Join WJCT, PNC Bank, and the YMCA for a Sesame Street dance party. Celebrating Sesame Street's 50th anniversary, Saturday, October 19th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at WJCT Studios. Enjoy a meet and greet with Walk Around Zoe, arts and crafts, and so much more. Reserve your spot today for this free, family-friendly community event by visiting wjct.org/events.
You do everything together. You know each other's secrets. You know what makes each other tick, and that's why betrayal hurts so much. On the next Snap Judgment, Turncoat. Storytelling with the B. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. It's a first-of-its-kind campaign to bring free mental health training to the public right here in Northeast Florida. Mental Health First Aid is a public education program that educates all of us about the warning signs of mental illness and helps us understand their impact. October is Mental Health Awareness Month, and what's exciting here is that a coalition of local hospitals is joining together to train anyone that's interested for free in mental health first aid. Joining us now with more, we welcome Dr. Ellen Williams, Senior Director of Behavioral Health at Ascension St. Vincent's. Good morning.
Good morning.
Willie Roberts is here, nurse manager, also a facilitator of this at Ascension. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Anne Marie Knight, partnership member with UF Health.
Good morning, Melissa.
All right. Thanks so much for being here. And you're not, by the way, the three of you aren't even representing all of the health systems that are taking part in mental health first aid. Let's begin with you, Dr. Williams. What is mental health first aid?
Mental health first aid is basically an evidence-based training that helps lay people not in the profession of mental health identify the signs and symptoms of a number of different kinds of mental illnesses and equips trainees with information about resources that people can access if they need them in a crisis. And that means resources across the board, whether it's professional help, seeking out support from peers or social support, and also some self-help resources.
All right. Let's talk to our nurse manager. You know, when we think about first aid, Willie, we think about giving someone mouth-to-mouth resuscitation or the Heimlich maneuver. This is a completely different notion. How does this training work? You've already trained thousands of people, right?
Yes, we have. I'm really excited about that. Well, the thing about the whole mental health first aid training was developed along the premise of CPR or CAB, which is chest compressions, airway, and breathing. So meaning that any lay person can be taught mental health first aid. So the whole premise of mental health first aid is to provide mental health literacy as well as to decrease stigma among lay persons within our communities.
Anne Marie Knight with UF Health JAX. This has been a top priority for all of the city's health institutions for several years now, because we don't have decent funding for mental and behavioral health treatment, and we've got a lot of suffering people in this community, right?
Right. So, you know, Brooks Rehab, Baptist Health, Mayo Clinic, St. Vincent's, and of course UF Health are involved in this collaboration. And it was born out of the last community health needs assessment in 2016. The data just kept repeating itself as far as the needs for mental illness support. It was interesting. Each hospital took the report back to their respective leaders and identified mental health as a priority. So when we sat together, our community engagement colleagues, we said, this is our space. We have to do something here. And we were drawn to mental health first aid because it's evidence-based. And it's the opportunity to engage with the lay citizen in our community to give them to provide some skills and training around this effort.
Now, Dr. Williams, you've trained about 8,000 people. Your goal is to train 10,000 people in this community by the end of this year. This is a free training course, but it's 8 hours long. Tell us more about how this works and what people will engage in, if you could.
Well, they are given a book that outlines the curriculum for the training, and they are taught step-by-step how to engage with people who are having a mental health crisis instead of disengaging. Like, early identification and treatment is the key to recovery of mental illness. So if everyone in the community is more aware of recognizing signs and symptoms, then they can help them get treatment more quickly. A key part of what's happening in this community, as well as equipping people in the faith communities and education organizations, is that our first responders are being trained to recognize when someone's going through a mental health crisis. So JSO has really committed to making sure all their officers are trained, and that's very important because they're often the first contact for people going in a crisis.
Yeah, sure. A few more statistics about mental health and mental illness in our area. Northeast Florida ranks as the second lowest region in the state for mental health funding, and Florida is one of the lowest funded states in the union. In this country, about 1 in 5 adults experiences mental illness of some kind in a given year. That's a lot of people, Willie Roberts. And people dealing with mental illness, as you said, face a lot of stigma. They are often misdiagnosed, misunderstood. There isn't funding out there to treat them. This is a public health crisis. And so you're really, this sounds to me like you're trying to engage all hands on deck, average people in the community to help out with this.
So when we talk about stigma, that is a major barrier to individual struggling with mental illness to access medical care and services. Mental illness is a disability. It's no different than any other health, chronic health disease or illness. So what our goal is with Mental Health First Aid is to teach our community and those individuals who want to participate, that we're advocating to participate in these classes, is to teach them signs and symptoms, as Dr. Williams had said, to teach them about mental health first aid action plan, how to identify someone in a crisis, resources to get them into care and services, because we know at least 50% of individuals living with mental illness is not in care or services.
Not getting care. Anne Marie Knight, what would be an example of a sign or symptom somebody observes in a coworker, a friend, or even just someone on the street that might not seem like mental illness, but that is a symptom? These are the kinds of things that we'll learn. I mean, you think about obvious behaviors that the average person would look at and go, well, clearly that person's got right. some kind of mental problem, but there might be some more subtle things
right.
too.
So one of the simple examples, and I'm not a facilitator, but I have taken the course, one of the things that comes to my mind is a simple change in behavior. Mm-hmm. So someone who may have been, who normally is very jovial, but then just seems a bit removed outside of their normal character. That's one of the simple signs. Now, that doesn't mean that they're having a behavioral or mental illness situation occurring, but it is a cue to maybe lean in a little bit and, you know, check on that person to see if there's any particular thing they need help with.
Right. So, Dr. Williams, that's one example of what folks will learn in this free class.
Yes. And some other things that may be overlooked usually are things like isolating. People who are usually engaged in things are isolating more, not attending maybe class if they're a young person, or missing days at work, or not going to church if they're usual churchgoers. So isolating is another example. Also chronic or consistent over time tearfulness, like easily upset or crying a lot, you know, sad. So these kinds of things are shouldn't be overlooked. Go ahead and ask a question. How are you doing? I've noticed that you're not as happy as you usually are. Is there something I can do?
Right. These are the kinds of things. This is just a quick window into what you will learn if you sign up to take a free class in mental health first aid. This is a free offering from a number of hospitals and health systems around town. Their goal is to get 10,000 people trained in mental health first aid by the end of this year. So go to mentalhealthfirstaid.org and sign up and register. Thank you so much, Dr. Ellen Williams, Willie Roberts, both with Ascension St. Vincent's, and Anne Marie Knight of UF Health Jacks. Again, that's mentalhealthfirstaid.org to get into this class. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you.
In a moment, we're going to celebrate Hispanic Heritage Month. Stay with us.
CNS Healthcare is seeking people who are experiencing memory loss to take part in a research study. Together, let's tackle memory loss and Alzheimer's disease. Learn more by calling CNS Healthcare at 904-281-5757.
Live Nation presents Chicago in concert at Daly's Place Friday, October 18th. Hits like Only the Beginning, Make Me Smile, and Saturday in the Park. Chicago at Daly's on Friday, October 18th. Tickets available online at Ticketmaster.com.
The biggest story in American politics is also involved in a shooting war with Russia. Ever since its breakup with the Soviet Union, Ukraine has been wooed by the West and invaded by an aggressive northern neighbor. Now it's at the heart of the Trump impeachment scandal. Foreign favors and murky money will explain Ukraine. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
At a camp in Dayton, Ohio, there's a program to help children whose parents are addicted to opioids. One camp activity, writing letters to addiction itself.
Dear addiction, why do adults like you? When I'm older, I will be against you. You make me not like my mom and dad, and it's sad. I hate you.
That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, how the same organization that fueled conspiracy theories about the Clintons in 2016 is behind the discredited story involving Joe Biden and his son's work in Ukraine. The organization was founded by Steve Bannon. We talk with journalist Joshua Green, who wrote a book about Bannon. I hope you'll join us. Today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Heritage Month is happening right now. This area, as many of us know, is seeing rapid growth in our local Hispanic population. Tracking the growth of that business space is the job of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. And they're marking Hispanic Heritage Month by handing out scholarships to 10 deserving local students. That's exciting. Monica Hernandez is president of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. This is a rapidly growing community and a rapidly growing business sector for Jacksonville. Tell us what you're seeing.
Well, you're seeing growth. I can tell you, I've been in Jacksonville for 14 years. And from when I started, from when I moved here initially, I've seen the growth tremendously from originally my friends being, you know, European or non-Hispanic to now, you know, it's just a very wide, diverse. And not only just from one country, but from a diverse or multiple countries in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Many different countries. Where did you move to Jacksonville from? Where did you come from, South Florida or somewhere else?
Ocala. I actually grew up in Ocala, Florida. Yeah.
You know, it's interesting as we look at the growth of this community in North Florida. I used to live in Orlando, and the Hispanic community there has grown by leaps and bounds. The growth here has been a little slower. But it's catching up. What do you think is driving in migration to Northeast Florida?
Well, you know, I think Jacksonville is like a hidden gem, right? It's a beautiful city. You have everything here. And people continue to move up north, or they just come down south from the Northeast. So you're seeing people that are coming from Miami, from Orlando, people that were affected by the Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico that are moving to Jacksonville looking for opportunities. And, you know, it's just word of mouth. And you are seeing Jacksonville coming in the news much more for being the city for where entrepreneurs should come, or, you know, for cost in terms of cost of living, it's better than other cities. So all of that drives attention to Jacksonville.
And certainly the tragedy of Hurricane Maria forced a lot of residents there to come over here to the mainland.
Yes.
At the same time, that's an opportunity for this area.
Absolutely.
How is the First Coast Hispanic Chamber working with the new Puerto Rican residents who are seeking jobs, opportunities here, maybe looking to start a business?
Well, I mean, I can tell you from a chamber perspective, what we do is that when they first started coming into the city, we would partner with other organizations to be a resource, to maybe connect them with nonprofits that could help them and assist them with them. Also, as an organization, we have workshops that are catered for entrepreneurs that are looking to start their businesses. So providing them basic information on what to, you know, what to think about, what tools they need to have access to, how to get access to capital, how to create a business plan. So all those little, well, sometimes we think are basic, you know, some of these individuals may not have access or know how to do it.
Okay, so the First Coast Hispanic Chamber is a vital resource then and is growing in influence. Let's talk quickly about the Achieving the Dream Gala. That's coming up October 11th at TIAA Bank Field, presented by the Jacksonville Jaguars. And you're going to have the president of the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce speak. So that's kind of a nice coup. What's going to be happening there?
Well, it's exciting. We actually will be celebrating a lot. One, it'll be the 20th anniversary for the Achieving the Dream. We have been, you know, the chamber has been awarding scholarships for 20 years now. Year to date, it will be about 170 scholarships that have been awarded. In addition to that, we're also celebrating that the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce was awarded the Chamber of the Year by the U.S. Hispanic Chamber of Commerce on October 2nd. So that's
how exciting
it is. And then,
congrats.
Of course, thank you. You know, it's just consistency and measurable success that, you know, the chamber has been working on throughout the years. And in addition to that, of course, we're celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month. As you know, it goes from September 15th through October 15th. So it'll be a great way to kind of culminate the whole month and celebrate culture and heritage.
It's interesting to note that North Florida counties led the state last year in the growth rate of their Hispanic population.
Yes.
So this is something to watch for
our
region.
Absolutely. I mean, right now the population in Jacksonville for Hispanics is at least at 9%. But I can tell you that I would see that I'm suspecting that's going to be different once the census happens. So, I mean, you'll see it with the businesses that keep coming up, more restaurants, more Hispanic-owned businesses in Jacksonville that are just flourishing.
Yeah. There has been so much growth in lots of different parts of town. So it is something to celebrate, and it is Hispanic Heritage Month. So we thank you, Monica, for stopping by. Kudos on your recognition, too, as the top Hispanic Chamber of Commerce in America.
Yes.
Very exciting. And they're Achieving the Dream Gala again happening this weekend at the bank. Thanks so much. She's Monica Hernandez, president of the First Coast Hispanic Chamber of Commerce.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you. That is our show. And thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum directs the show. Jessica Palumbo is station news director. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. We always want your feedback. Send those comments to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, North Florida Congressman Al Lawson joins us in studio to discuss the impeachment inquiry against the president. That's coming up tomorrow. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. If you're sitting in on our rebroadcast tonight, later on tonight, keep listening for some great music. We'll see you in the morning.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.